Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be David Montgomery. He is the author of a great book called Growing a Revolution. I'll tell you more about him in just a little bit when he comes on. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in the news and some things that I participated in this week that were really exciting. As you all know, this was Earth Week, and so lots of great things were taking place all around the country and the world. I got to participate last Thursday in a food conference at Hofstra University, which was a wonderful conference about growing the food movement on Long Island. And Mark Winnie, who was our keynote speaker, who was a guest on my show a few weeks prior, talked about bringing all the different stakeholders together to work together, because so often when we're working on whatever our mission is, we're in our own little silos and everyone's working really diligently on what they're working on without lifting their head up and looking out around and seeing all the other people working on the same issues and ways that we can pool our resources and our energy so that we can really make momentum and catapult this movement into real policy change so that we can see some results. And so this conference was really great. There were people from all different sectors of the food movement and environmental movement that spoke at Hofstra University. And then following the conference, we took a little tour of some of the local food entrepreneurs in the area. Actually, one is Flowers and Sons Oyster Farm, which is actually in Oyster Bay, and they are really replenishing the oceans with beautiful oysters and the bay with beautiful oysters and clams, and we saw their production in action. And then we went over to Young's Farm, which has been around for 40 years, or actually more than 40 years. And they, very excitedly, last 3 years have been transitioning to organic. And so they're no longer using chemical fertilizers. And they hired a nice, wonderful young farmer who is Aiden, who is really using some innovative methods to grow vegetables that they're going to sell right there on at their farm stand. So that was really exciting. And then we went to the North Shore Land Alliance, which is our local land alliance that has been saving so much land from Nassau County for conservation, from being able to prevent it from development and keep it in production in farmland. And we don't have too much farmland left in Nassau County, so that we do have, or not even just farmland, but just open space, keeping it from being developed is really great. So that was Thursday. And then yesterday, Monday, I was up at in Albany. I took a bus up with the Long Island Progressive Coalition and Food and Water Watch to Albany to participate in a wonderful march and rally for Governor Cuomo's benefit. We're calling it Walk the Talk. Governor Cuomo is very good at talking the talk, but he doesn't really walk the talk. He talks about banning fracking in New York State, which he did, and we were all so excited. But meanwhile, he has built up the infrastructure to support the fracking that's going on in our neighboring Pennsylvania, meaning that he's approved pipelines that are transporting the gas from the fracked wells, which is predominantly methane, which is much more environmentally threatening than just CO2. And it's and of course it leaks and it spews methane into the environment and the fracked gas. He also imports the dirty fracked water that they use for de-icing on our roads. They're building a pipeline right next to Indian Point that is right near a nuclear power plant that has already been highlighted to be closed and is way past its time of being closed. I mean, now I think they're planning on closing it by 2021, but it really should have been closed years ago. It's really a dangerous power plant and so close to New York City. I mean, if anything happened there, if there was a meltdown, we all in this area would be impacted. And there is no exit strategy. He promised us a risk assessment. He, meaning Governor Cuomo, promised a risk assessment over 2 years ago. We still don't know what the risk assessment is of the Spectra pipeline running right by the Indian power plant. And now I just learned of this new pipeline, which I guess the people that live in Orange County and Dutchess County have known about it for a while. But I just learned about it when I was up at the rally. But this is called the CPV power plant. And this plant is a frat gas plant that is being built now. It was approved on bribed money. I guess one of Governor Cuomo's associates, someone in his team, has already been indicted for it and pled guilty. But they're still going ahead with this CPV gas plant, and it is set to raise gas emissions by 20 million tons or release 20 million tons of CO2 per year. And it is just a really, really horrible thing. This gas plant is only 60 miles outside of New York City. It will be the largest fossil fuel power plant in New York State. And it is just a really bad thing. People living near power plants have increased asthma, respiratory disease, heart disease, cancer rates, and they're estimating that that will happen in this area as well. And people upstate New York are really trying to fight it, and we need to help them. So I'm going to ask all of you to call Governor Cuomo's office. The three main themes of the rally and march that I went to on Monday was, one, to end the building up of the infrastructure for fracked gas. We need to stop that in its tracks right now. So that's one. The other one is to hold corporate polluters accountable for the messes and the accidents and the spills that are happening, and even for people's health care, for the increased rates of asthma and respiratory disease and dirty water. And then three is to move us towards renewable energy, get us off fossil fuels. And we really, really need to do this. So this gas plant also will contaminate the Croton Reservoir, which supplies all of New York City's water. And it's being built on protected farmland, the wetlands, a Native American burial site. And it also runs right through the famous Black Dirt Farms, the area of New York State that is has such rich soil. So we really need to stop this. So please call Governor Cuomo. You can call at 518-474-8390. Again, that's 518-474-8390. And I have this information on my website as well, so check that out. There are lots of wonderful things coming up in and around the New York area. Of course, right now is Long Island Restaurant Week, so if you're in Long Island, you might want to take advantage of that. There is an event taking place at the Academy of St. Joseph's in Brentwood, and this is a climate change on Long Island, a lived experience, and there's going to be lots of people from Food and Water Watch, Long Island Progressive Coalition, some legislators talking about climate change and how it's relating to Long Island. So if you're interested in that, check that out. There's a spring festival going on at Cold Spring Harbor Lab, sheep shearing going on at Stone Barns on April 28th. I heard that was sold out, but if you're interested, you might want to just go and show up. At Project Farmhouse, which is in New York City, a great, great community space now for anything that's environment and foodie, they're screening a film called Farmers for America, and I'm planning on going on April 30th. Project Farmhouse is on 13th Street on the east side, and it's only $10. There'll be a great discussion following. Lindsay Shute from the National Young Farmers Coalition will be there. So come check that out. We really need to encourage people to go into farming. You know, the majority of the farmers in our country are 60 or over, and we really need to make farming a viable living for young people. And, you know, it's very exciting, the buzz that farming is having, especially in the sustainability world, but we really need to make it more accessible, finding ways of getting farmland into the hands of these young people that want to farm it. So that's all really exciting. And I have a recipe I want to share with you. It is a gluten-free and vegan fruit tort. I used blueberries because I still had some frozen organic wild blueberries from Maine that I wanted to use before I got into the season this summer. So this is I did it gluten-free and vegan. And it was more like a coffee cake than a fruit tort because I didn't put a lot of sweetener in it. If you want it sweeter, of course, you can add some more honey. I used just half a cup, but this is what I used. A half a cup of honey, a cup of unsweetened shredded coconut, a half a cup of coconut oil, 2 flaxseed eggs. And so for that, I used 2 tablespoons of ground flaxseed, 1 tablespoon of water, and 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar. 1 cup of gluten-free vegan Pamela's flour, 1 teaspoon baking soda, 1 teaspoon baking powder, a pinch of salt, a cup of frozen blueberries, a cup of frozen banana. I always have my frozen bananas in the freezer. Every time my bananas start getting too ripe, I just peel them and stick them in the freezer, and they're great to just throw into smoothies or desserts like this. 1 teaspoon zest of a lemon, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, and then I sprinkled some cinnamon and cardamom on top. So I preheated the oven to 350, and in a small bowl, I mixed the water, the apple cider vinegar, and the ground flax seeds together, and just let that stand for a while. And that acts like an egg. It gets glutinous and kind of works as a binder in this recipe. Then using a standing mixer, I mixed the honey with the coconut oil. Then I added the flaxseed, the vanilla, and the lemon zest. And in a separate bowl, I mixed the dry ingredients, which was the flour, the baking powder, the baking soda, and the salt. Then I added back to the mixer. And then after that was all mixed together, I added the fruit, just combined it till it was all together, and then spooned the batter into a tort pan that had a removable bottom. And, you know, the edges are fluted, so it's really pretty when you, after you bake it and you take it out. And I baked it for about 20 minutes. My pan is, I think, like 10 and a half inches, so it's a little bit larger. If you have a 9-inch, you might have to go more like 40 minutes. So depending on the size of your pan will depend on how long you're going to cook it for. But you know it's ready when it starts pulling away from the side. You can always test it with a knife into the center and see that nothing sticks to the knife, and that's how you know it's finished. And let it cool on a cooling rack for at least 10 minutes before you try to remove it from the pan. And then I sprinkled it with some cinnamon and some cardamom, and that was it. And it was, I sprinkled it with the cinnamon and the cardamom before I baked it, and that was it. And if you want, you can also sprinkle it with powdered sugar when you remove it if you want that look. And it was delicious. Like I said, we ate it as a coffee cake all week long, and it was really, really wonderful. And so now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week. David Montgomery is a MacArthur Fellow and a professor of geomorphology, and I'll let him tell us what that is, at the University of Washington. He is an internationally recognized geologist who studies landscape evolution and the effects of geological processes on ecological systems and human societies. He's an author of award-winning popular science books, and he's been featured in documentary films, network, and cable news, and on a wide variety of TV and radio programs, including Nova, PBS NewsHour, Fox and Friends, and All Things Considered, which is one of my favorite public radio shows. His latest book, Growing a Revolution, explores innovative and cost-effective practices being used by farmers around the world based on conservation agriculture, which restores the soil health and fertility. He also co-authored the book, The Hidden Half of Nature, with his wife, Anne Bilkley, who I interviewed last week, which explores the parallels between garden health and our gut. And I'm really happy to have David with us. David, are you here?
Yes, Bhavani, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And now I'm really hungry. That sounded delicious.
Yeah, it is good. I hope you make it. Let me know. For everybody out there listening, if you make the recipes, I'd love to get some feedback. So let me know how you liked it. So first, tell us what a geomorphology is.
Geomorphology is the science of what shapes the surface of the earth. So, 100 years ago, I might have been called a physical geographer or a topographer. So it's kind of the here and now of geology, how erosion shapes hillsides and mountain ranges, how rivers create the habitat that things like salmon out here in the Pacific Northwest, where Ann and I live, use. So it's really sort of what's shaping that the part of the world that in our daily lives we see and recognize as the world we walk on, but that you usually think of geology as about the rocks that are underneath. Well, a geomorphologist studies how those rocks erode and get shaped at the surface of the world to create the landscapes that we live on and walk around on, and that means that it's very directly relevant to things like natural hazards, landslides, and flooding, or how you can sustain a society with agriculture, how soils form, and how they change as a result of our farming practices. So that's, in a nutshell, really what a geomorphologist looks at. We've got a wide palette to work on in studying the surface of the earth, and it's a really fun discipline because you have to know geology, you have to know physics, you have to know biology because the plants and animals on a landscape can influence it over long periods of time, and it also ends up directly relating back to ecological impacts of human activities and how our impacts on the land, in turn, can impact our societies. So it's a really fun discipline to be in. But, yeah, it's a little obscure with that name, geomorphology. But it's a great corner of the earth sciences.
Uh-huh. Great. And how did you get into that? Tell us a little bit about your background and what inspired you to study this.
Well, it's like with so many people's lives, it's sort of a circuitous trip, but I think it really started in California, where I grew up. I did a lot of hiking and just wandering around in nature, and I loved reading maps. As a kid, I always was fascinated with maps and navigation and just sort of knowing where I was in terrain, and that, I think, really acclimated me to thinking not so much about how the landscape formed, but just our relationship to it. And then when I got to college, I was all set to become a biologist, which is what Anne, my wife, actually is. But I got a little disillusioned with the undergrad program at the college, the university I was at, and ended up taking a geology class and thought it was fascinating. And the students were helping each other instead of sabotaging each other's experiments. And I got really turned on to geology and then to geomorphology in particular, and sort of just kept going, ran with it. And now I'm in the odd position of looking at how geomorphology affects not just the shape of the surface of the earth, but back to how it shapes ecological systems and the biology I was so interested in high school, and also our own societies. So it's sort of a, if I look back through the evolution of my own career, I never would have predicted what I've been working on and where I've ended up, but it's been a lot of fun in studying the world and our relationship to it.
Yeah, I hear you. I know how careers go, and they always don't go the way you think they're going to go. As John Lennon said, life is what happens when you're busy making plans, and you
yes.
just put one foot in front of the other, and you see where it takes you. So
yeah.
Well,
yeah, and I feel very privileged to have been able to work in an area that I find intellectually fascinating and personally quite rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book is beautiful, Growing a Revolution, and
thank you, so
committed to sustainable agriculture. And when I say sustainable, I'm meaning, one that is good for the earth, because I realize after my conference last week where we had the Farm Bureau part of the conference, for the Farm Bureau, sustainable is also the economic viability, which of course is a real part of it, but it doesn't do any good if it's economically viable if it's also ruining our soil and earth. So it has to be good in both areas for me to consider it sustainable. So your book is just great about that. You know, really, you explored so many different farms. Can you tell us a little bit about your adventure and how you came to write Growing a Revolution?
Sure. You know, and I'm right there with you in that sustainable farming needs to work not only for the farmers but for the land. The trick is getting both of those lined up. And as a geologist,
absolutely,
I'm accustomed to thinking over the long run. So, you know, we're not talking years or decades. We're talking decades to centuries and when we need to get those lined up. And, you know, you talked to Anne last week about our experience writing The Hidden Half of Nature, and that experience really set the stage for working on Growing a Revolution because, you know, to recap quite briefly, Anne and I bought a house in North Seattle back in the 1990s. She's a gardener who really wanted to have a beautiful garden. The house that we purchased did not have a beautiful garden. It had a ratty old lawn. And she transformed the yard. Watching her transform the yard into a thriving garden through, in essence, feeding the soil organic matter and building up the organic matter and the microbial life and the health and fertility of our urban lot in North Seattle really opened my eyes to how fast it's possible to rebuild healthy, fertile soils from stuff that was probably better characterized as dirt. And when we got sort of well into that transformation, I was working on problems of looking at how to make agriculture more sustainable from a long-term perspective in terms of soil erosion and soil degradation. And I came away from the garden restoration project that Anne was the lead on to thinking, well, could we do this on farms around the world? You know, how fast could we actually rebuild the organic matter and the fertility of the world's farmlands through changing our farming practices? Could what Anne did in our yard be done at scale on large, you know, farms in the Western world? And could it also, could the similar kinds of practices or ideas work on smaller, smallholder farms in the developing world? So I ended up taking about 6 months off from my job teaching at the University of Washington, where I sort of reprogrammed myself to go around and talk to farmers around the world who had already restored fertility to their land. They'd taken degraded farms and rebuilt their productivity, and that had helped not only restore the health of their soil, but helped to restore the viability of their farms, the economic health of the farmers. And I ended up writing what was, I think, a surprisingly optimistic book about the potential to really make farming practices much more sustainable in ways that satisfy your double goal of things working not only for the farmers but for the earth. And, I describe experiences from farmers in Costa Rica, in equatorial West Africa, in Ghana, and across North America. And, you know, as a geologist, my job wasn't to go and tell farmers how to build the fertility of their soil. I've studied soil formation from the process of, you know, how do you break rocks up to make soil? And the part that's typically missing from agricultural soils that have been worked with conventional agriculture for a long time isn't the mineral part. It's often the biological part, the part that Anne really studies. And my job in visiting farmers who had restored fertility to their land was to ask them, well, what'd you do? Tell me your story. Walk me through it, and then give me a shovel, because I'm going to dig a hole in your fields, and then I'm going to go to your neighbor's field and dig a hole over there and look at the soil and evaluate it and to try and put the story together at the higher level of what worked across the board for farmers in Africa and Costa Rica and the United States and Canada. And that's where my job came in, is to try and synthesize what are the general principles behind farming practices that could really rebuild soil fertility as a consequence of intensive farming. And that's where I landed on the optimistic take of this book, because I found that there are people who are doing it, and there were common principles. The actual practices that you would use in different areas were, of course, different. You wouldn't farm the same way in Ghana as you farm in Costa Rica or the Dakotas. But there's a common set of principles that could guide how you could restore fertility to land while at the same time making a healthy living off of it. And the key is restoring the health and fertility of the soil. And that's what the book is really all about, how the motivation for why we would need to do that, how we can do that, and examples of farmers in very different settings who've used these same principles to really transform their farms and, in many cases, their regions and neighborhoods as their neighbor farmers realize that, wow, this is working not only economically, but you're restoring the health of your land. And this is resonates, I think, very well with people who live so close to the land.
Mm-hmm. So can you share with us what the commonalities were that you found?
Yeah, it boils down to really three simple principles, which are the principles that underpin a set of practices that are known as conservation agriculture. And those simple principles are don't disturb the soil, which means in a gardening application, don't do a lot of digging. And on a farm, it means no plowing. So going to no-till farming, which is actually a fairly new innovation and has the way it's practiced in many parts of the world so far have their own issues and problems we could talk about. But the idea of not disturbing the soil was foundational to these farmers who had rebuilt the fertility of their land. But that's not all they did. The second principle was keep the ground covered. And so that translates into planting cover crops, keeping living plants with live roots that are pushing carbohydrates and proteins and fats out into the soil to feed the microbial life in the soil. Keep the ground always covered with those with living plants to protect the soil from erosion and to help feed the microbes that are beneficial for the plants. And then the third principle was growing a diversity of crops. And so you can summarize that as really sort of ditch the plow, cover up, and grow diversity. Those are the three principles that translated across the board. And when you think about what those things do, collectively, that's a recipe for cultivating the beneficial life in the soil. But they're also, those three principles, are 180 degrees from the principles that have guided modern conventional agriculture for most of the 20th and now 21st century, where we've relied on intensive tillage, a lot of plowing, the use of agrochemicals as a substitute for native fertility of the land, and we grow one or two crops, functional monocultures. So what I basically am arguing in the book is that we need to think about soil very differently from the way we've been thinking about it for the last 100 years. And these three principles of ditching the plow, covering up, and growing diversity offer, in essence, a philosophy of farming that we can design practices around for different settings, whether small farms or large farms or in the tropics or in the temperate zones and for whatever crops people are growing. The trick is to adapt practices to those principles and adapt that to the land, where we spent most of the 20th century trying to make the land adapt to our Western farming practices. And it's resulted in widespread soil degradation that is an ongoing problem, and unless we address it, likely to get worse. But the practices based on these principles of conservation agriculture can actually turn it around remarkably fast. And what really turned me into an optimist on this issue is that by rebuilding the health and fertility of their land, the farmers I visited across the board were reducing their expenses for diesel because they're not driving their tractors as much across their fields. They reduced their expenses for fertilizer because as they restored fertility to their land, they found they didn't need as much. And they also reduced their expenses on pesticides, herbicides, and insecticides. And yet their harvests were as large as their conventional neighbors. So they were spending less money to grow the same amount of food. So their income was not reduced. In some cases, it was increased by greater harvests, but their expenses were greatly reduced. And that's a recipe for a more profitable farm. So it was a real eye-opening experience for a geologist to sort of realize that thinking about the soil differently was really foundational to building a sustainable agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us any idea as to why you think these principles are not being taken up more readily with how you explain it? It makes so much sense. I mean, farmers are going to save money and have the same, if not better, crops, and it just doesn't make sense that more and more farmers are not transitioning to this sustainable conservation agriculture. You know, I don't want to call it organic because some of them just, you know, their hair just goes on end when you mention the word organic. So let's call it conservation agriculture.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
Why don't you think more people, when it's just so obvious that the fertilizers, the chemicals, the pesticides, that, you know, that all the bad that that brings to our farming, why aren't more farm bureaus really pushing the organics?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And a big part of it goes back to the sort of the history of farming in the 20th century, where by the 1920s and 30s, when fertilizer use really became much more widespread, and then in the post-war years, in the later half of the 20th century, we had managed at that point to already degrade farmland across, you know, Europe and much of North America relative to what the native fertility of the soil was. So crop yields had been going down at that point, and the application of a lot of fertilizer to the land actually brought yields back up. And then the Green Revolution with the fertilizer-loving crop varieties that were introduced then, we saw big increases in yields as a result of using many of the products that this new conservation agriculture style can wean us off of. And we tended to think about the problem of, well, we tended to prioritize yield above all else. And so there was a major move in the Western world to really follow through and develop chemical-intensive agriculture because it was very productive when you had degraded soil. Mm-hmm. And we didn't understand enough at that time about the role of microbial life in building the fertility of the land and the role of soil organic matter in feeding that microbial life that was the sort of the engine for natural recycling of nutrients and native soil fertility. Much of that science and our understanding of it really only dates from the last couple decades in terms of the mechanics. There were very early pioneers of organic agriculture, people like Lady Eve Balfour and Sir Albert Howard in England, who intuited the role of mycorrhizal fungi and bacteria and nutrient cycling in the health of the soil. But in their day, the science hadn't really caught up in terms of explaining how it worked. And so their views were kind of steamrollered by the demonstrated success of fertilizer-intensive agriculture in boosting yields. But that those boosts came at a cost of degradation of the land in many, at a broad scale. And we're now getting to the point where we understand the mechanics of how those microbial connections work, which I imagine that you talked more with Anne about last week, but the way that those communities of bacteria and fungi in the soil help acquire nutrients for plants, help bolster their defenses. And I think it's sort of no real mystery now that we understand those connections, the symbiotic relations between soil life and our crops and plants. It's really no mystery why the sales of pesticides went through the roof after the sales of fertilizers went through the roof, because we kind of dismantled our crops' natural defensive mechanisms by changing the nature of the life in the soil and the fertility of our soils, the native fertility of our soils. Mm-hmm. So those the sort of the history of how that evolved led to a situation where if you look at who's mostly advising farmers on how to grow food these days, and for the last 50 years, it's people who are trying to sell them those very products that these new practices of conservation agriculture can wean farmers off of. So there's sort of there's at one level an information gap, and there's also a research gap where if you look at those three principles of going to no-till farming, cover crops, and a diverse rotation, we've tended to study in the agronomic sciences is each of those as a separate piece. So people will study, what does going to no-till do? Or they study, what does rotating crops do? How does that help? But if it's the combination of all three practices that give you the real boost in fertility that leads to the benefits of being able to reduce those chemical inputs, there's just not that many studies that have addressed a systems level with all three. And that's what I tried to do in Growing a Revolution, is find those studies and then also find the examples of farmers who've been doing this for 10, 20, 30 years, 44 years in one case, and look at what has happened to their soil as, you know, and that's a long-term experiment, but it wasn't done in an academic setting. It was done on somebody's farm. It's a real-world thing. So what I wanted to
which
do
is what
is,
we have to look at, because there's no money for the kind of research you're talking about, because the people that fund research, as we know, are the chemical companies that are going to benefit from the sales of their chemicals. But anyway, I would love you to share with us some of those stories. But before we do, let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, maybe you can share with us some of the stories of farmers that you saw who are doing it the right way, or the way I believe is right, and share some of that with us. So everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with David Montgomery, author of Growing a Revolution. Be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear Jill Stein and Ralph Nader, and the independent candidates, and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm with my guest, David Montgomery, author of Growing a Revolution, and we're talking about soil conservation, and he spent 6 months traveling around the country and the world looking at examples of farmers who are really using conservation principles to build up the biological fertility of their soil. And I just asked him before the break if he would share with us some of those stories. So, David, are you with me?
Yeah, no, and happy to share those stories. Personally, I found them quite inspiring. The folks that I visited were an amazing collection of individuals in very different settings. But the commonalities in what they had done were what really sparked in me this optimistic view that we can reverse the long-term problem of soil degradation and, you know, make both conventional and organic farms more sustainable. One of the first people I visited was a gentleman named Dwayne Beck, who runs Dakota Lakes Research Farm in just outside of Pierre, South Dakota. So it's right about on the 100th meridian, right where Lewis and Clark came through, you know, the river just on the edge of their property.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's done is he's basically operated a demonstration research farm now for a few decades that is owned by a whole network of farmers, but it's operated by South Dakota State University. So it's a real partnership between academia and farmers, and the goal is to try and figure out ways to reduce the costs of farming, increase yields, and they ended up starting with going to no-till practices out of an interest in reducing irrigation. And when you plow up a field, you might think that would help water that falls as rain sink into the ground. But what it does instead, we found out, or they found out, and that others have replicated, is that by plowing the soil and breaking it up, you're kind of pulverizing it and turning it into a powder. and you're breaking up all those worm tubes and the aggregates in the soil, the sort of clumps. You know, if you've ever dug into the soil and there's like a dirt clod, the clumps sticking together, that helps create void spaces between those clumps, and the worm tubes help water sink down into the soil. When you plow, you break all that up, and you pulverize the surface, and if you have a powder, and you add water to it, kind of like if you have like a bowl of flour and you dribble a little water on the surface, you get a crust on the top. You get the mm-hmm. same thing on a plowed field. And when it crusts up with that first rainfall, the next rain that falls on it flows off over the surface and causes erosion that can carry your soil, your seeds, and your fertilizer away. So it's not beneficial. So they got into no-till to try and save water from irrigation and keep the water that falls on their fields in the soil where it can nourish their plants. And then they got into looking at adding cover crops and diversifying the rotations. And so now, decades into their research, what they've been able to do is design a system of farming that, you know, grows the sort of cash crops of North American commodity agriculture, corn, wheat, and soybeans. But they also plant other things in their fields as cover crops, both in between their crops in time and sometimes even in the rows in between the crops that they've planted to get diversity in. And what it's done is it's cut their diesel use by half, because they're taking half the trips across the field because they're not plowing. And they've reduced their fertilizer and pesticide use by, you know, more than half. And this has resulted in greater farm income. And I was impressed with how those ideas have spread around the community that Duane is working in, as farmers gradually realize that, you know, these crazy people doing these new practices were actually doing better off, and their soil was much nicer. And if there's one thing that most farmers I've met can actually do, is that they can look at soil and they recognize healthy, fertile soil. And many of them that I've talked to that had inherited farms complained that they didn't have the soil that their grandparents were farming. That they had that mm-hmm. they recognized the degradation of the soil through conventional practices. So these guys in South Dakota were working some pretty big farms. They got up to like 20,000 acres, you know, large mechanized North American farms. And I was really impressed with how they had rebuilt their fertility on these farms, which weren't really organic, but I started calling them organic-ish because they had so reduced their chemical use. And I then, you know, went from there to Costa Rica and Equatorial Africa, and to look at whether or not these same ideas, the minimal disturbance cover crops and diversity of crops, you know, what that could do for smallholder farms in the developing world. And the place that really inspired me was visiting a gentleman named Kofi Boa in Ghana, who runs the Center for No-Till farming near Kumasi in Ghana. And he's converted people around his village from their traditional slash-and-burn practices, where you'd take, clear a little piece of forest, burn it to release nutrients into the soil, farm it for a couple years, and then move on to another piece of ground and let the jungle grow back over that. It's a very traditional practice in many parts of the world, including Neolithic Europe, where that style of farming could work as long as you have the land to rotate around. But what happens when your population gets big enough that you have to keep farming the same ground year after year? If you burn it year after year, you're basically running the organic matter down. You're basically degrading the fertility of the land in the way they grow food. What Kofi did is he taught the people in his area a very different way to farm, which involved not digging, keeping the ground always covered with mulch and with the residue from a previous crop, and then growing a diversity of crops in the same field. And they basically those principles of conservation agriculture. And what he was able to do is stop the soil degradation and reverse it, rebuild the fertility of their land. So they went from about 1% soil organic matter back up to 4 or 5%, which in the tropics is really good. And very healthy and fertile. They also were able to double their corn yields and triple their corn yields and double their cowpea yields without adding additional fertilizer or without using herbicides. And that's really important in Africa, because these farmers are people who, the whole Green Revolution idea of selling people fertilizer-dependent crops and GMO crops, engineered crops, doesn't really work very well for smallholder farmers for the simple reason that they don't have the money to buy those inputs, to buy those seeds, to buy the pesticides. What Kofi taught them was a way based on these principles that use their labor and the tools that they have access to on their very small farms to greatly increase their harvests by restoring fertility to their land. And this had a transformative effect on the village, where people before Kofi was starting were, hardly anyone owned their own farm. And when I visited, a decade or so into their transformation, all the farmers that I met owned their own farm. It had a transformative effect on the area. So that was another really inspiring story to me. And then the last one that I'll share with you is a gentleman near Carroll, Ohio, named David Brandt, who is a farmer who grows corn, wheat, and soybeans for the North American commodity markets, but he also grows very diverse mixtures of cover crops in between his cash crops. And he's managed to virtually wean himself off of fertilizers and herbicides and pesticides by going to no-till with other means of weed control, where he's using his cover crops to essentially smother out weeds, and then he kills the cover crops, lets them rot, and they feed the microbes in his soil that then recycle those cover crops into the fertilizer. So it's using it as green manure that then helps support the growth of his cash crops. And he's much more profitable than his neighbor's conventional farms. And the question you originally asked of why aren't more farmers waking up to this way of doing things, that's a really good question for his neighborhood, because he's still a bit of an island of green in a sea of degraded land. I think he just bought his neighbor's degraded farm because he's that profitable and they were that tenuous.
Unprofitable,
and he's going to start converting that farm as well. So, I think it can take decades for good ideas to get out of the sort of experimental mode and spread through society. But I think these are ideas that work so well once you figure out how to adapt them to a region, that once the genie's out of the bottle, once you uncork it, these ideas are going to spread. And my hope is that what we now think of as conventional agriculture will gradually become, or maybe not so gradually, become what I call this organic-ish style of agriculture. And some of these same principles, like minimal tillage, can really help build the sustainability of organic farms as well. And so if we can make the idea of boosting soil health the foundation for however we farm, whether it's conventional or organic, it could have the potential to quite literally change the world.
Mm-hmm. It could, and it needs to, because, to me, like you said, it's a win-win situation. It does not make sense to continue down the path we've been going. And the other thing that always cracks me up is how we consider, the vegetables we grow are like specialty crops, and the traditional agriculture, real agriculture is the wheat, corn, and soy, which is not the plants that most people eat. And they refer to, broccoli and carrots, things that people eat as specialty crops.
Essential to our health.
Right.
Yeah.
They are.
If you look at sort of the human health as the goal, as it should be for agriculture, we need to worry about not only how we're growing stuff, but what we're growing and what we're eating. And I was shocked to read a study, I forget, a year or two ago, that basically said that if all North Americans ate the USDA recommended portions of fruits and vegetables every day, we don't grow enough to actually feed that to people.
Right.
And that's just like, oh no, we're growing a lot of corn, soy, and wheat, only some of which actually goes to feed people.
Somehow we have to undo the whole premise and the makeup of money being involved in the business of agriculture, not from the farmers. I mean, the farmers certainly work hard and are entitled to make a good living, a better living than many of them are. But we need to get the chemical companies out of it, because it's just such big business. you know, even trying to find ways to use the corn, you know, whether it's, and the soy, whether it's, you know, to create ethanol for our gas, which actually, you know, they use more fertilizer and, you know, more pollution is created in growing the crops to create the ethanol than we're saving from not using gas instead of using the ethanol instead of the gas. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
and so many of these recipes don't make sense.
And if we grow the corn for the ethanol in ways that actually erode the soil, then, you know, we're undermining the long-term viability of civilization to fill up our gas tanks.
Right. So instead of win-win, it's stupid, you know?
Yes, exactly, yes. Dumb.
It doesn't make sense. So we need to, you know, we need to get politics and corporate money, like we need to separate. The same way we had to separate church and state. We got to separate corporations and what's good for the people, because it's just, you know, it's just not. It's, you know, there's too much, you know, backdoor deal making that keeps this going. I mean, you know, I don't know what's behind all the farm bureaus for them not taking this on more, because it's there is enough science out there. There's not the level of research that you maybe have had on some of the GMO crops and the fertilizers and pesticides, but there's so much research, if you just look at the examples like you did, to show and prove that this makes sense. This is good business. It's good money. It's good health. It's good environment. It's good everything.
It's good for the farmers, and it's good for society. And what we need, what we really need to do, is to have much greater support for the farmers who are adopting the practices that build healthy, fertile soils, and, you know, rewarding and if need be, subsidizing them to transition to that. But to be, you know, if there's one thing that society as a collective whole has a really compelling long-term interest in, it's in the health and the fertility of our farmland. And that's the story about what happens when people don't pay attention to that is the book that I wrote before The Hidden Half of Nature, the one that I was writing. It was called Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, that looked back at how farming practices influenced ancient societies. And the basic, you know, one-sentence summary of that book is societies that did not take care of their land, that didn't protect their soil, did not last. And we simply can't afford to repeat that exercise at a global scale this time, the way it was done in Mesopotamia and classical Greece and Rome and other societies around the world. We've really got to figure out how to make farming sustainable in terms of building soil fertility as a consequence of how we farm, because our experience for most of the 10,000-year history of agriculture has been that over time, farming practices have degraded the land. And we can do it much faster now with modern technology. But I think we can be more clever. If we think about adopting these principles of conservation agriculture, we can take the best of modern science, couple it with the ancient wisdom of crop rotations and cover crops, because those are not new ideas. They were traditional ideas around the world because they worked.
Right.
But in the past, they've almost always been coupled with plowing, with tillage. And over the long run, that undermines the good that the cover crops and the diversity do. Now we have the technology to put those together and merge modern science with ancient wisdom. And I think that's what I see as the potential for a soil health revolution, is to really get those two things, those three things, all lined up in a new system of farming, or new systems of farming, because, you know, exactly what you do in Ghana is not what you do in the Dakotas. But the goals and the principles that guide them should be the same. And that's why I think of this focus on soil health as really having the potential for a new, being the equivalent of a new agricultural revolution that could reshape farming well into the future, my hope, at least.
Now, did you come across any, with permaculture, you know, there's more emphasis being put on planting plants that, you know, that are more perennial, that come back every year as opposed to just the annual crops. Did you see any more of that taking place?
Oh, yeah. There's, I visited one agroforestry operation down in Costa Rica that was, you know, had both tree crops and other crops all sort of merged together into what was essentially a food forest, a food jungle. It was amazing, a bit of landscape. But the other end of that are the kind of things that people like Wes Jackson have been doing at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, developing perennial grains. So they've developed a wheat grass that is essentially much like wheat. You can generate flour that makes excellent bread and beer out of it is a perennial crop. So you don't plow it. You don't disturb the soil. It grows year after year. The roots get bigger and bigger. It puts more carbon in the ground. And they're experimenting with trying to develop other perennial crops. And the one that they have now, this wheatgrass, is called Kernza. And if people have, if you run across Kernza products, buy them, try them. It's great stuff, and it's
How
much
do you
better
spell it?
For the land. Kernza, I believe. Kernza. And it's basically a wheat. It's basically a wheat substitute. It's not wheat, but it's very similar. And they developed this through the old-fashioned style of genetic modification, crop breeding. They put in, 40 years worth of the cross this with that to try and get a plant that would work for that. And they're now commercially growing it and licensing it. And it has the potential to be, really revolutionary in the sense that, that's a whole different style of no-till, that first principle of conservation agriculture. If mm-hmm. your plant survives year to year and is a perennial rather than an annual, you can build up the quality and fertility, not just of the soil, but of the plants themselves.
Right. Right. That's really exciting. So what are your plans? Do you have another book project you're working on?
Yeah, that's sort of the perennial curse of being a writer. and Ann and I have actually started working on another book that provisionally we're calling it Harvesting Health, although we're not, that may change by the time it's done. But what we want to look at is the connection between how we grow our food and how it affects human health, and whether or not this style of regenerative agriculture, like conservation agriculture, does it grow more nutrient-dense, more nutrient-rich, healthier food for us? And can that influence and impact our health? And we're just starting to dig into that. And hopefully we'll get it researched and written within a year or so. But, things always take longer than you think. But
Good.
It's one
I
of these
know,
things
I'm still
where...
working on mine. It's been 5 years.
Yeah, it
so
always
I'm
takes
really
much
on the
longer
slow
than
path.
You think. But, the indications so far are it looks to us like we can make the argument that the style of farming that's good for the earth is actually good for us, too.
Absolutely. Well, David, we are just about out of time. You want to just share with people how they can find you on the web?
Yeah, sure. Ann and I have a website. It's www.dig2grow.com. That's dig the number 2 and then grow.com. And we're also active on Twitter, at dig2grow, dig the number 2, grow. And on our website, if people want to email us, there's an email address on our website. You can find stuff there. And the
Wonderful.
Books, are available, Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, The Hidden Half of Nature, and Growing a Revolution. We call that our Dirt Trilogy. And people interested in farming and agriculture and sustainability can check into those, and you don't have to read them in order. It's not like The Lord of the Rings. You can read them in whatever order you wish and understand the whole
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. And I'll share all those links on my website. So everyone, if you didn't get it down, you'll find them on my website at ieatgreen.com. And David, thank you so much for joining me. It's been so informative. I love the work you and Anne are doing together and separately, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Bhavani. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You're welcome. And everyone listening, thanks for joining in, and I'll see you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.